Water and technology. Brothers and sisters, we now have opportunity to listen to our brother Klein on one of a two-part series, Lessons from Jeremiah. Brother Klein, please.
Well, good evening, everyone. First of all, I'd like to say that, in a way, I didn't pick the hymns tonight. You know, we have this protocol in our ecclesia where you have to hand in hymns and readings to the presiding brother, and you can actually read about that in the hymn book, which will, God willing, be published eventually, soon. And Brother Fred is probably the only one that ever asked me for hymns and readings, and which always puts me under a considerable amount of stress, because I wouldn't think of them at all, at least until just before we spoke. However, you know, one of the things we have in the new hymn book is a list of suggested readings. Now, some of the readings that they suggest are clearly taken verbatim out of the scripture. So therefore, if it's a psalm or something like that, you have the reading listed at the back. With Jeremiah, there's four specific hymns. And the first two that we have here tonight were taken from that list. And quite frankly, I hadn't even read them until we sang them tonight. And let's turn to hymn 340. Because when I scanned it, I thought, well, this doesn't make any sense at all. But when we sang it, it made a whole lot of sense. And first of all, it's really kind of an overview of what Jeremiah is all about. In verse 2, for example, 'tis ours to obey, 'tis his to provide. Now, we will see this reoccurring theme throughout the book of Jeremiah, especially in the early chapters. That what Jeremiah is basically saying is, well, you people are in this predicament because of choices that you've made. And if you just obeyed, then God would provide. And it's very similar to what Brother Jamie just said. And the problem was that the people didn't obey. And so therefore the consequence was dire. It was really horrible. Though dark be our way, since he is our guide, 'tis ours to obey. So it's about the darkness of human thinking. And one of the great verses about human nature is in Jeremiah chapter 17, which gives us great insight and guides us in our understanding of what we are and who we are and how we really think. So though dark be our way, there is hope in Jeremiah, but it's not a big part of what Jeremiah talks about, which is another difficult thing, I think, for us to understand as we go through. He talks a lot more about the dire consequences. He talks a lot more about the negative than he does about the positive. And we'll just go to Jeremiah chapter 1. And some of these thoughts are somewhat random as we begin. But in Jeremiah chapter 1, where we have pretty much a summary of the whole book, the whole work. If you read chapter 1, you pretty much have the summary. You know what's happening and where it's going and what it's all about. Well, you notice in verse 10 of Jeremiah chapter 1, after the Lord touches his mouth and says, now I have put my words into your mouth, he says, see in verse 10, today I appoint you over nations and kingdoms, and here's what's going to happen. And I'm reading from the NIV, and it'll probably be very similar because there are six verb-type phrases here, and four of them have to do with destruction, and two of them have to do with hope. And just think about it. I will appoint you over nations and kingdoms to uproot, to tear down, to destroy, and to overthrow, and to build and to plant. So we have four statements about destruction and two about hope. And that may well be about the portion, proportion of each as we move through Jeremiah. Back to hymn 340, though cisterns be broken and creatures all fail, the word he has spoken will surely prevail. And in reference to that, Jeremiah is only mentioned, Well, in 2 Chronicles chapter 35 and 36, he's mentioned in Ezra chapter 1 and 1 and Daniel 9, 2, outside of the book itself. And, of course, his name comes up continually within the book, and there's a reason for that, which we'll probably look at a bit more later, and that was it was a very personal prophecy, because the word of Jeremiah is like dozens and dozens of times come up, where it doesn't happen in Isaiah, for example. It doesn't happen in Ezekiel to anything like the same extent. But in Jeremiah, his name is mentioned constantly throughout the prophecy. Now, what are these verses about? In 2 Chronicles 35, 25, 36, 12, 36, 21, and 36, 22, 1, 2, 3, 4 times by the chronicler was basically to say that this happened according to the word spoken by God to Jeremiah the prophet. So the prophecies of Jeremiah came true, and this is emphasized four times in the last two books of Chronicles, 2 Chronicles. Ezra, of course, repeats it, and Daniel repeats it in relation to the fact that the message of the 70 years of Jeremiah had also come true. So the other writers from outside of Jeremiah conclude and reinforce the fact that everything that Jeremiah had said had come true. Now, that is exactly what God says to Jeremiah in chapter 1 at the very beginning. There was never any doubt that every single word that Jeremiah would speak would in fact come true. And so, again, the hymn is quite appropriate. Though cisterns be broken, and of course he went through some dramas in his prophecy, a number of dramas that hopefully we'll have time to sort of contrast and look at. Went through a number of little dramas, including taking a pot and breaking it. So cisterns being broken and creatures all failing, definitely very big themes in Jeremiah. Why should we complain of want or distress, temptation or pain? He told us no less. And he did too, didn't he? In Jeremiah chapter 1, he said that even though they were against him, the priests and the kings, and verse 18, for example, verse 17, get ready, yourself ready, stand up and say to them, whatever I command you, do not be terrified by them, or I will terrify you before them. Verse 18, today I have made you a fortified city, an iron pillar and a bronze wall to stand against the whole land, against the kings of Judah, its officials, its priests, and the people of the land. They will fight against you, but they will not overcome you. So that was the history and the life of Jeremiah was constant pain and suffering, really. And a lot of that was poured out in the book of Lamentations, which seems to be, everyone agrees, was his lamentations after the death of Josiah. And there was great hope, actually, as we'll see in a moment, in relation to the reign of Josiah the king. And Jeremiah seemed to be very, very prominent in that, although there's no record in the Kings and Chronicles to indicate that, just some indications that we can see. They will fight against you, but you will not... They will not overcome you, for I am with you, and I will rescue you. He told us no less. God told us that we will have suffering. Every godly person will have suffering. There's many ways that we have suffering. We have physical suffering, which Jeremiah had a lot of, but we also have mental suffering, which Jeremiah probably had even a lot more of. So the heirs of salvation, we know from his word, through much tribulation must follow their Lord. So again, good hymn and certainly a good choice. While there's no direct reference there, certainly the hymn lines up very, very well with the prophecy of Jeremiah. Jeremiah probably ministered for around 40 years, perhaps a few more. And again, we know this because in the first couple of verses of chapter 1, we're told that the word of the Lord came to him in the 13th year of the reign of Josiah. So we have some specific information about the beginning of his reign, and we have some specific information about the end of his reign, which was really the 11th year of Zedekiah, son of Josiah, king of Judah. And we know from the record itself, of Jeremiah's record, that he was involved with the the events that surrounded the assassination of Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, and the flight into Egypt. So we don't know any more about Jeremiah than the fact that it would appear he went down into Egypt at the end of his life, and at that time he would have been probably well over 60 years of age, perhaps even as much as 70. We don't know really how old he was when he began, but we certainly know that the 13th year of Josiah was a significant time. And in this outline here of his contemporaries, we know that Zephaniah, for example, lined up with the same period of time. We know that Obadiah and the message of Obadiah most likely lined up with the time of Jeremiah, because Obadiah speaks specifically about Edomite raiders who raided the city of Jerusalem during a succession of sieges by the Babylonians. And so quite clearly Obadiah lines up, at least in my opinion, lines up with the message of Jeremiah. Now, 2 Kings, let's go there. 2 Kings chapter 22. And there's this interesting record of the prophetess Huldah. Now, Jeremiah is not mentioned in 2 Kings 22, but we have Josiah beginning to reign when he was 8 years old. And we have Huldah mentioned here in verse 14. Speaking to the prophetess Huldah. And in here, if I'm not mistaken, we have this this reformation that takes place, and I can't see it, in the 18th year. Sorry, yes. Thank you. Verse 3. The 18th year of his reign, Josiah sent his secretary, and so on. There was this great reformation in the days of Josiah, and in the 18th year, and Jeremiah begins to reign in the 13th year of Josiah. That's really the point we're trying to make here. And so we have reason to believe that the work of Jeremiah had some effect on Josiah, and so the beginning of Jeremiah's prophecy was probably a time of great optimism, because during that 5 years from the time he began his ministry, according to the words of Jeremiah chapter 2, until the beginning of the Reformation and the finding of the book of the law in the temple was only 5 years. So I think we have good reason to believe that Jeremiah was hugely influential in that. Now, Ezekiel, of course, was contemporary, more or less. His work was different. His work was primarily with the exiles of Judah. We know that there were a number of captivities, a succession of raids by Babylon, and finally the temple was overthrown in about 585. Daniel, of course, lines up the same period. Daniel was probably in the captivity of the first major captivity. We can read about that in Daniel chapter 1, verse 1. And most likely Nahum and Habakkuk were also contemporary with Jeremiah. So there was a lot going on, basically. And the comment at the bottom of this slide is that something we already know, I guess, and that is that the four major prophets in the Old Testament, Daniel, the three of the four major prophets in the Old Testament, had to do with the captivity. Now, there's lots of reason to understand, at least, why that was so, because when we think that the nation of Judah, which had really been established by King David about 1000 BC approximately, was really the kingdom of God on earth, and the temple that was built by Solomon was one of the great wonders of the world, and God had established this kingdom to be a light-bearing nation and a light-bearing kingdom to the whole world. The nation, of course, failed God. Judah, not as bad as Israel, but certainly Judah failed in the end. There was certainly a massive declension in the reign of Manasseh, And Manasseh, of course, reigned for 52 years. His son was Josiah. And so the reform under Josiah was clearly too little too late for the nation of Judah. And it also, I think, indicates, brethren and sisters, that the issues that were in Jeremiah's day didn't just come about in the reign of Manasseh, the 52-year evil reign of Manasseh. They were inherent and had been there for quite some time. Now, we don't want to spend a lot of time on the history because you can find the history of this quite easily, but during the course of Jeremiah's prophecy, beginning with the reign of Josiah in the 13th year, he reigned through into the succession of the last four kings of Judah. And the time is about 40 years, approximately, from the 13th year of Josiah to the fall of Jerusalem and the assassination of Gedaliah. Approximately 40 years is spanned there. So the message isn't continuous. It's a bit spotty, as you'll see on, I think, on the next slide. He went through two short reigns of 3 months of Jehoahaz and Jehoiachin, a longer reign of Jehoiakim, and a 14-year reign of King Zedekiah. And it was a sad series of reigns, obviously, until such times as the nation fell and the people who were left fled into Egypt. Significant events, the call of Jeremiah in 626 BC, the fall of Nineveh. In this 40 years, the whole world changed, basically, because the historical powers that had been there, which were Assyria in the north, began its decline around the time of Isaiah and never really recovered, but was finally overrun by the armies of Babylon from the east. The fall of Nineveh around 612. Josiah dies at Megiddo in 609. We had the Battle of Carchemish. We had the Egyptians who were coming up trying to stop the Babylonians. They were driven back, of course, and the Babylonians finally came right down into the land and laid siege to Jerusalem in 605 BC. And that's most likely, as we all, I think, believe, was when Daniel and many of the princes of Jerusalem were carried off to Babylon. There were at least three sieges that we know of. The second one was about 597, and the final one was around 586. With the final 588 to 586, with the final overthrow of the nation in 585. What is the structure of Jeremiah? Well, not unlike some of the other prophets, he is a bit random in terms of the chronology of it. And that's why if we sit down as we have done recently and read through it in our readings, we've got to be careful about making sure we know approximately where we're at. Certainly the reign of Josiah, most likely in chapters 1 to 6, there's nothing really that hooks us to any reign, it would appear, between in the reign of Jehoahaz. The reign of Jehoiakim, quite a few references that we have there, the reign of Jehoiachin, again, dates and times, and the reign of Zedekiah, quite a few dates and times that can sort of clue us into what's going on in the time period. Jeremiah was easily the foremost prophet in the Old Testament. Now, I hadn't really thought of that until I had this opportunity to go through this thought process. By sheer volume of words, he's bigger than Isaiah and bigger than Jeremiah and bigger than Ezekiel. I'm not sure what that means, other than the fact that he was the largest prophet. He's probably the least quoted, and that might not be totally accurate. Isaiah was quoted the most of any of the Old Testament prophets. Jeremiah is quoted very few times, maybe half a dozen times in the New Testament. He was the most autobiographical of any of the prophets. And we said that before about the fact that his name is constantly reoccurring throughout the prophecy. dozens and dozens of times. He's speaking in the first person. People are talking to Jeremiah. There's comments about Jeremiah. This isn't true of the other prophets anything like as much. He was credited with the survival of the remnant that was left of the people after the fall of Jerusalem. Now, it's a sad story, really. It's a sad commentary, not only on the nation of Judah, but it's a sad commentary on human nature. Because after, and again, this struck me when we were reading this recently, that after all that Jeremiah had gone through, and after the king of Babylon had come and constantly said, look, I don't want to destroy you people. I don't want to have to take it you out. And that's, you know, part of the history of going down there two or three times. It would appear in Nebuchadnezzar's mind to liquidate the nation of Judah, but they wouldn't cooperate. The kings of Judah wouldn't simply cooperate. So he had to keep going back and sort of straightening the thing out. And finally he got angry and just wiped the city out. He got tired of the insubordination. And there was really no reason for them to be insubordinate to the king of Babylon. It's a most amazing story. We're talking about a few thousand people in a little outpost on a highway down to Egypt, who had been beat up by the Egyptians, had been beat up by the Assyrians. There was very little left of the kingdom of Judah after the Assyrians had got through, because they'd destroyed most of the defense cities of Judah. Really, Judah was Jerusalem and some outlying farming communities and a few outposts. There was really very little there. And yet these people who were sitting there around Solomon's temple, or what was left of Solomon's temple, challenging the Babylonians. It was sheer, absolute nonsense. And then after the Babylonians have given them two or three opportunities to come in line and say, look, just do as you're told, pay your tribute, farm the land, they finally had to be destroyed. They left this guy, Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, who had some royal blood in him, I guess, from the tribe, from the family of David. They left him there sort of as a regent to kind of take after the people, as a governor, to kind of look after the people who were left. And it wasn't very long before this guy, Ishmael, comes along and assassinates him. And then in panic, because they knew that the Babylonians would be back, they fled into Egypt, which was something God said, you must not go down into Egypt. And off they go down into Egypt. So at the end of the story, the nation was completely, pretty much destroyed. There was hardly anybody even left in the land, as God had said to them that they should be vine dressers, you know, just at least stay there and plow the fields and dress the vines. Because they were coming back in 70 years, which is another thing that Jeremiah told them. You're going to come back in 70 years. So God wanted the land, and by their own stupidity, unbelievable stupidity. And part of it was, as we'll see, was because they really believed they were special folks. Well, Solomon's temple was there. This was the temple of the Lord, they said. This is the temple of the Lord. This is not going to happen. Jeremiah had a very, very unpopular a job, because he had to go to say to them that the temple was going to be destroyed and that the nation was going to be destroyed. And these people just didn't get it, clearly. The temple of the Lord. The temple of the Lord. The temple of the Lord, they said. As some kind of a mantra, they recited this. And at the same time they were saying the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, they were baking cakes to the Queen of Heaven on one side of a petition that was in the temple, and worshiping the God of Israel on the other side of the petition in the temple. And still saying, well, nothing's going to happen. We're God's people. And they were absolutely boneheaded about it. And we can see this as Jeremiah had to go and basically bang heads with them. An unbelievably difficult job. He never gave up in his love for his people, which is a great lesson. We're talking about the lessons from Jeremiah. A great lesson from Jeremiah is that even though he had a most unpopular message that hardly anybody in the nation agreed with, he kept on for 40 years with this message. I don't know whether Jeremiah is the least read of all the prophets. He probably is. I went looking for commentaries on Jeremiah, and I only had one in my library. And I think I mentioned before, my library is 122 feet long. And I had one commentary on Jeremiah, and that was the one that I just mentioned here, which is part of a series, the Expositor's Bible Commentary. It's a very good commentary if anybody's looking for a really good Bible commentary. But nothing else I could find on Jeremiah. And my sister said to me, oh, there is a book on Jeremiah out there. Haven't you seen it? It's a little thin book like that. And I said, well, if it's a little thin book like that on Jeremiah, I'm not sure it would be really very comprehensive anyway. There's no clear arrangement. We've already seen that in the previous overhead. The messages are scattered around a little bit, and it's a little difficult to see it in a chronological way, but I don't think that matters anyway. Longer span than Isaiah or Ezekiel. It sheds, his work sheds a tremendous amount of insight into the final days, the tragic final days of the nation of Judah. And it was a horrendous time. It was a horrendous time because God was moving his nation out. He was demolishing his kingdom on earth. God was taking it apart. Even the temple that had been built to house his glory and to bear his name, he was taking it apart. It was a horrendous, horrendous time in the history of Judah and also in biblical history. Now, Jeremiah, there's some interesting little connections with Jeremiah that I'm not really fully sure we can trace down entirely. Harold mentioned one in Matthew when we talked about the potter's field and buying the field, and Zechariah talks about the pieces of silver, and Jeremiah buys a field in Anathoth for 17 pieces of silver, I guess. My NIV calls them shekels. There was a reference to buying a field, and it was in Anathoth, just outside the city of Jerusalem in the territory of Benjamin. So Jeremiah was a priest, of course, and he lived in Anathoth, and Anathoth was probably a priestly city. We know that Saul came from the tribe of Benjamin. We know that Paul came from the tribe of Benjamin. The tribe of Benjamin played very heavily in the history of the nation of Judah, especially. He was told by God to go and buy a field and redeem a field, basically, from one of his relations. Jeremiah comments on this after he's gone, and he had to get the deed and the title change witness so that the transfer of the field into Jeremiah's name was a matter of public record. And there was some very specific events that surrounded that, which, God willing, we may have a look at a bit later. And Jeremiah commented on that, basically said after it was all done, and his buddy Barak had the deed and carried the deed and, I guess, put it away for safekeeping. He basically almost exclaimed in a statement to God that is like, wow, you are an amazing, merciful God, because while you are taking this country apart, you're actually saying to me, go and buy that field and plant something there, because we're talking about redemption, we're talking about the return, we're talking about the rebuilding. And Jeremiah was quite taken by it. It's an interesting part of the prophecy to read. But the reason I say this is because I believe that the field that was repurchased by the high priest with the money from Judas might well have been that field. I don't know why it would have been mentioned otherwise and made an issue in the New Testament. And if it is, there may be some very interesting issues that we could pursue. He was by birth a priest, by grace a prophet, by trials of life a bulwark of God's truth, by daily experience one of the greatest exponents of prophetic faith, in a personal, and this I think is so valuable in the record of Jeremiah, the personal, special personal relationship that he had with God. I don't think there's any other prophet, Daniel perhaps, but no other prophet for such a long period of time remains in a personal relationship with his God. He was gentle and timid. He was not bombastic in any of his utterances or in any of his messages. He was constantly extending and contending, against the forces of sin in a very gentle, timid, really Christ-like manner, for the most part. He constantly sought love and companionship. You can see that as you go through. It was all denied him. He was isolated. He had one close companion, Barak the scribe, which is a wonderful little human interest story in the prophets. And I think really he was there as part of what we read about in Jeremiah chapter 1. Do not be afraid of them, for I am with you and will rescue you. They will fight against you in verse 19, but they will not overcome you, for I will be with you and I will rescue you. And I think that God also clearly put this man, Baruch, there as a constant companion and a source of strength for Jeremiah. And this is one of the other great lessons, one of the many great lessons of Jeremiah, how that we really do, brethren and sisters, need our brethren and sisters for support in the work. It makes it possibly bearable. It does put the presence of God often in the miracle of companionship and fellowship, puts that into the equation and makes life much more doable. These were politically, socially, morally, and spiritually chaotic times. The morality of the nation had all but gone. And this wasn't, as I say, due to some 52 years in the life of Manasseh. This was something inherent that had been brooding for a long time. And I know when we were reading through the Kings this year, in our recent readings in the Kings and Chronicles, how that this phrase kept coming up and keeps coming up, where, you know, you have this good king, Josiah and Uzziah and all of these good kings that came along. They followed the Lord like David their father had done. They did this, they did that, and they did something else, yet they did not remove the high places. And that comes up over and over and over again. I think if you did a search in Kings and Chronicles, it would come up dozens of times. Yet they did not remove the high places. They did not cut down the groves. And the people were supposed to worship in Jerusalem. They weren't supposed to set up little rest stations or sacrifice stations around the country. They're supposed to do it in specific spots that were ordained by God. Well, what they had done is they said, well, you know, it's a long way or whatever, so we'll get into worshiping over here. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that if you're kind of running your own little church on the hill over here in your own little grove, the possibility of getting out of line is huge. The possibility of not sort of comparing what you were doing with other people, which could happen at Jerusalem. You went down there and the priests kept it straight. So there was a huge potential for people to be getting into what I'm going to call a synchreistic kind of religion, you know, where all sorts of things would be okay. The pure worship of the God of Israel could easily be corrupted. Not corrupted so much, because these were good folks. They were intelligent folks. They knew the law, pretty much. They kind of lost the book out of the temple for a while, but they had the history. But it was so easy to just bring in the other stuff. And we were discussing Ahaz, one of the bad kings of Judah, who was making some deals with the Syrians and went up to Damascus. And remember, he got up to Damascus, and, well, the Syrians were fairly prosperous folks, pretty good army, And they'd been harassing Israel to the north. So this looked pretty good to a king of Judah, Ahaz, the king of Judah. So we went up there, and of course they checked out these kings. They checked out the other guy's religion. Find out what they were doing in their temples. And they thought, well, if you're doing these and successful and so on, prosperous and winning your battles, you must be doing something right. So he found this altar, as we know, and he liked the altar, so he had one of his people draw it up, do a blueprint for it, and send it back down to Jerusalem and said, get this thing ready, and when I get back, I want one of these things built. And by the way, once you get it built, you'll have to rearrange the furniture in the temple because we'll need to make room for this and put those other altars over there, and we'll put mine over here, and then the common folks can put their sacrifices on that one, and I'll do this on mine. So I mean, this is just an illustration of how this came in over hundreds, I'm sure, hundreds of years where these possibilities were out there. We'll end on this tonight. I have two overheads on, I think two overheads on Jeremiah and Jesus. I never thought of this before because you don't think of Jeremiah as a type of Christ. Well, maybe you have, but I really honestly haven't. But the similarities are huge. They both, of course, did their ministry at huge times of change in Israel and in Jerusalem. Jeremiah was doing his ministry for 40 years before the final destruction of God's temple. Jesus had 3.5 years, about 40 years before the destruction of the temple, approximately. These were hugely insignificant and troubling times. So the historical settings of both of these prophets were very similar. There was a formalism in Jesus' time, a traditional formalism, that was slightly different than the idolatry of Jeremiah's time. It was nevertheless idolatry. In fact, it might have been worse in Jesus' time. The idolatry became the traditions and so on, and who they were and the folks. In Jeremiah's time, it was that, plus all the stone and the wooden idols and so on. Both had a message to Israel and to the whole world. Clearly, Jeremiah was not just going to the house of Israel, as Isaiah was a little bit more directed towards. He was directed to the whole world. Both were very conscious of nature. In chapter 1, we have an almond branch, and this is a very common reoccurring theme in Jeremiah, where he goes to nature. Jesus, of course, did the same. Both came from high traditions, Jeremiah a priest and a prophet, and Jesus from the kingly line of David. Both were very conscious of their call from God. Both condemned the commercialism of the temple in fairly similar words, as a matter of fact. If you look at Jeremiah chapter 7 and verse 11, he talks about the commercialism of the temple and about the fact that it needed to be driven out. And I think probably the comment in Matthew chapter 21 and in the other gospel records about it was most likely drawn from the statements in Jeremiah. Both were accused of political treason. Both were tried, persecuted, imprisoned, falsely accused. Jesus, of course, died. Jeremiah, it would appear, didn't die under the persecution of his message, as God had declared in chapter 1. He probably died in Egypt. Both foretold the destruction of the temple, clearly. Both wept over Jerusalem. Huge emotion over the city of Jerusalem. Both were forcefully condemned by the priests of their day. Both were rejected by their own people. Both were tender-hearted. Jeremiah was so much like the man of sorrow that the rabbis, the Hebrew rabbis throughout history, basically have lined Jeremiah up with the suffering servant of Isaiah chapter 53, and I don't think we can escape that connection. Both knew the meaning of loneliness, isolated. Jesus to the very end, when his own disciples couldn't watch with him for even an hour. Both enjoyed unusual fellowship with God. There's no other prophet in the Old Testament that I can see that had such a close fellowship with God. one of the unique features of Jeremiah's life was that he could be so free to be so honest in his communication and his conversation with God. And we have repeated examples of that beginning in Jeremiah chapter 1. So I'll leave that with you, brethren and sisters, and I don't know whether you thought, oh, he's going to go right through all of these overheads, but perhaps if you can hang on to them and bring them back, we'll look at them, God willing, and the rest of this in October and November when we're going to do the second part of it. Thank you.